Yes.
And do you want my best radio voice?
Yes. Yes. Would you like to announce?
You and I later.
Would you like to announce our next tune? That was Radar Love by Golden Earring.
And before, Banana.
Right. And before that, we heard Smoke on the Water by Deep Purple. And prior to that. Okay, are we ready?
Yes.
Should we do something here?
Let's do it.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
No one knows what we do before these interviews.
We've been doing it. It's all done.
This band was nuts, literally.
Yeah. Oof.
Found you guys outside.
Food, tried to plug stuff in.
What a mess.
Yeah, that's us.
Well, here's the bottom line. This is the early one. This is what shows up in my hands out of nowhere. And I have a very bad long-term memory. Mm-hmm. So I go, Ian Moore, okay, right. And they don't give me anything. There's nothing here, right?
I've never even seen that.
No history. There's no nothing. And, you know, and I'm saying, okay, wait. I know I've played them in the past, but nothing.
Right.
So all I get here is RIYD, which is their way of telling, you know, people like me, if you've played Elvis Costello, Wilco, Ryan Adams, and the Deers, let's start with the basic history because as we get to question number four, I'll help you weave through it.
Okay.
But why the hell are you here, Ian?
Well, they told me to drive north on I-5 and to watch out for the truck pileup, and so we did.
But a little bit of history. So it all started in Texas.
Yeah, I grew up in Texas. Actually, was hanging out last night with an old friend of my dad that started a club called the Vulcan Gas Company. My folks used to go there when I was a kid. And man, there's just always been a great music scene in Austin, and my parents were huge music fans, so grew up with all of that. Started playing, you know, when I was like 17, 18, and played all over Texas, and I mean, built things up, tore them down, tried a bunch of different styles, kind of pissed some people off, you know, lost my mind a few times.
The Texas-based label, you're still on a Texas-based Justice Records.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I have anything else in my collection on Justice Records, or do I, and I don't realize it.
Well, they went through a period of non-activity. They released a ton of stuff. They did a lot of that Twisted Willie record, some Jesse Dayton stuff, some Super Sucker stuff, a lot of that kind of stuff, more like punkabilly and Texas, whatever you call that kind of music. But I've known Randall for a long time. I mean, you know, labels are conduits, and they offered me an opportunity to put out a record that I made with pretty good distribution and some money behind it, so I took it.
You started on Capricorn, which, of course, was famous for, you know, the Tuckers and the Allmans and all of that, and they dropped you.
There's a lot of backstory behind that. I signed with Capricorn because basically at that point, there weren't a lot of independent labels. There wasn't this like this plethora of amazing independents that there are now. Now, whether they actually, you know what I mean? There weren't people doing that. If you were kind of rootsy, you had Alligator, you had Rounder, you had some European labels. There weren't a lot of options. So when I started talking to labels, the lack of knowledge about American roots music at any label was astounding. And when I sat down with Phil Walden, who had managed Otis Redding and Sam Cooke and all of these guys, I didn't give a crap about the Allman Brothers. That wasn't my thing.
But it was more about his history before forming the label.
Yeah, he and I just sat down because I was a musicology major at UT, and I grew up around a lot of that stuff, and it was really cool to sit down with someone like that. We really bonded over that, and Phil and I really, really liked a lot of the same music. But the problem was his identity was still rooted in Georgia. And the difference between Southeastern music and Texas music is like the difference between San Francisco and, you know, I don't know, San Jose or something. They're just very different entities, you know.
So then you went to Yep Rock, which actually is still, to me, an amazing label. The mix of things. Nick Lowe's new record is on Yep Rock.
Terrific record.
I want to read you the quote of what you described your music as back in the Yep Rock days, because it was way too revealing. Stevie Wonder encapsulates some of it, but a lot of my music isn't soul-oriented. I consider it Southern Gothic, like Flannery O'Connor, that whole creepy feeling with lots of shades and subtleties. It includes soul, gospel, and Appalachian stuff, plus a lot of Celtic and Indian music. I don't effing know, man.
Yeah, that was when I was, yeah.
So are you still as confused as you were back then?
Sure, probably.
Tell me about the players and where you recorded it and who produced it. And
I produced it myself and engineered a lot
of
it
myself. How dare you?
I know. And I had a lot of help along the way. My friend Matt, who's with us, who's actually...
You want to say hello, Matt?
Hi, how's it going out there?
Nice. Very rock and roll of you.
He's a San Francisco... I don't know. You're not a native. What are you?
Bay Area.
Wow. He was involved with it. A lot of it was conceptualizing, and I really liked Matt's when I was wanting to get into some of these sounds. Cullen was playing with me on the road.
Say hello, Cullen.
Hello, Cullen.
How did I know that? Hello, Newman. That was so absolutely predictable. It's almost worth cutting out, but we won't.
I couldn't help it.
I know. And, hello, Cullen.
He was on the road with me. When I met him, he was a doctoral student at the University of Kentucky playing classical trumpet. So it was kind of like a basically dragged him through the...
all that, and we get that.
Right.
Yeah, I've learned a lot more since I left school.
I don't think so, based on what I just heard there.
Thank you for that special moment. John Hollis over here, the guy holding the brushes, plays drums with me up in Seattle.
John, who's going to play one of the most creative pieces of drum paraphernalia we've had in here in a little while, right?
So John played some percussion stuff and some orchestral timpani. He timpanied our song to make it into something special. And now Cornbread had absolutely nothing to do with the record, but I've known Cornbread for a really long time. And not that you wouldn't have had something to do with the record.
Moral support.
We're all busy.
Yeah, but we've known each other for a long time. We played with a lot of the same people, and so he's out playing bass with us.
Were you going, this is, and I'll say this hopefully in a respectful way, it's a slick record. This is not a lo-fi recording.
No, I didn't want to make a lo-fi recording.
Now, did you do it digitally or did you do it analog or did you do it both?
Well, I mean, yeah, I recorded to Pro Tools, but every piece of gear that I used, you know, I used LA-2As and 1176s and old mics. I mean, the medium.
It sounds like that.
So many people talk about digital and analog, and you literally can put it in front of like 2,000 people, and there's like two people that really can hear the difference, and they're probably one of the guys that's got it mastered by record. I mean, I think more it has a lot to do with the way you record to tape and the way you record digitally. People have a tendency to push tape a little bit harder, so it distorts, and people are used to hearing that, and that's really the main difference, man, 90% of the time. As far as like, I definitely did not want to make a lo-fi record because I'm sick of hearing those kind of records. I think that's really tired right now. You know, that's already been done by people way better than me. You know, and that was 15 years ago when all that stuff started.
So when you put this all together, was there any sort of overriding theme or was it, I've got a bunch of good songs, let's, you know.
Well, I wanted to make a record, you know, I just wanted to make a kind of classic pop record. I wanted to take all these influences and try to do something that wasn't that typical kind of indie rock thing that everyone does right now. I didn't want it to be obtuse and abstract. I wanted it to be focused and terse. I wanted it to be classic but not overly derivative. I didn't want to do one of those records where it was, quote, an influence. Literary Kind is definitely the most derivative song on there, which is why I didn't put it first originally. That was going to be the sequencing. And, yeah, that was the mindset, is just make a record that's really, really classic. As much as I could pull off, you know.
So tell me a little bit about subject matter, though. Like, for example, Civil Light.
Well, that actually came out. I had a guy that I was touring with for a long time that was a very, he had an engineer's mind. And we used to talk about, he would just go on and on and on about different types of engines and this and that. And at one point we got on one of these long grinder drives, a military discussion about different military terms. And I never heard the term Civil Light before, which, of course, is the military term for dusk. And I wanted to write a song about interpersonal relationships in cerebral hipster towns, like particularly in Portland, where everybody's so in their own trip that they don't
know. Coffee in their blood 24 hours a day.
Don't know how to relate with each other, and there's probably quite a few people like that in San Francisco.
Oh, no, never.
Seattle, and any town like this. Where you try to get all these people together and they're just so socially lacking and they're so awkward that it's...
So this could be a song for the Web 2.0 age.
I want it, yeah.
This could be the Facebook theme song.
Possibly.
If they need a theme song, you know, and they're bought for $1 billion, perhaps you can sell them the licensing.
I'll take $1 billion.
Yeah.
I'd even go in the hundreds of millions just to kind of give him a deal.
Just to give him such a deal?
Yeah.
And Innocent Maneuvers was kind of a bookend to a certain extent to that song, right?
Sure.
So tell me on this album, what is the one that when people hear it, because you said you set up to make a pop album, and it's funny, one of my original questions, but I tend to get to it without even writing it down, is, you know, I was going to ask you if you were afraid to call this a pop album, because the definition of pop in this day and age, so that badge is okie dokie by you, even though given your musicology and, you know, coming from roots and all of that, that's okay.
I think there's every bit as much depth to pop music as there is to blues or jazz or anything. You
it
know?
Just doesn't get the same respect.
Yeah, because
respect,
it doesn't look as good, you know, with a pipe and a tweed jacket.
I was just going to say you can't always do this and do this.
Like, you know, you sit around, and when I was really really into like all the soul and blues stuff, I always had my friend that was real into like SST or garage rock, and you go to the record shows and everybody's got their own trip, and you sit around and talk about it. It's all cool to me, man. It's all just different things, you know? They're all kind of the same pursuit.
One of the things I read on the blog, I just can't resist going there, is some of the things that you have had to do. We'll pretend we're the NME for just a couple of minutes here.
Okay.
You know.
Cool.
So the Andy Dick show, amazing that he's still alive. And I just read, I only had about a minute to kind of read about what went on there. So can you, because number one, my listeners probably aren't even sure that he's still alive.
And, if he has any right
to be, given the maniac that he is.
Well, you know, I was really just fast. Well, there's two things that happened out of it. It's funny because the label was really excited about us doing the Andy Dick show, as if that was going to translate into record sales.
Massive sales.
Massive sales.
Because Andy Dick's audience
love.
Is your audience. Right. I think they are definitely your audience.
Well, I think what happens is people that get into number crunching start looking at people as these numbers with a couple of little variations on them.
Oh,
so they
yes.
just look, you know. Yeah, it seems though that if he had pulled back a little bit, if he was success oriented, was taking his like weird, funky, messed up trip, trying to make some money on it, he would have pulled back a little bit when he had all the series and stuff going on, but he didn't.
He just kept plowing through.
Which makes you realize there's something wrong with him, which is kind of intriguing to me. So I was
so
trying
you
to
saw
figure
this
out.
As, so you saw this as a challenge.
I was just
how
looking
to make
at
it
him
through
like
this.
It was like, you know, Diane Goodall looking at, you know, chimps or something, you know. You know, to be honest.
And the other thing that I read is, I guess you do have a big distributor in the Universal folks, and I was intrigued, but I want to hear you tell me the story about the showcase that you had the pleasure of playing right after someone I play very, very heavily on my radio show on a constant basis.
Kanye, you're
yes.
big. You're almost outside of yourself looking at yourself doing all these strange things. And probably one of my favorite things to do in my career is when you run into other friends of yours that have done the same stuff and you're having drinks talking about the most perverse thing you've ever done.
That's kind of like talking about shows at the Viper Room and knowing that the stage is you're going to revolve on the stage and that the smoke is going to magically appear and that the engineer is going to tell you how to do the mix every single time.
Sure.
Yeah, that it's very important.
Yeah, it's really fun. I mean, you know, you just get up there and you do that stuff. You try to do, you know, for one thing, when I get an opportunity to sell a record that I made that I'm proud of, I'll pretty much do anything I can to get it out to people. I have no, you know,
shame whatsoever.
I'm really proud of that. I mean, it's like to me, like going out and just working for what you've done. Somewhere when that aesthetic got passed around that it's not cool to do that, I didn't get that particular memo, I guess. Must have been sleeping.
Yeah, you were sleeping. I like the reference, though, that you, when you were referring to the appearance, and I want you to explain a little more, that it was kind of like Rockpile in 1982.
Yeah, well, we just came out doing this thing that obviously was not in the
sights yeah.
of, because, you know, there is always a voice for every particular type of person in the industry's mind, and whether it's Kanye's thing that's more rock and hip-hop, so that's what Universal goes, oh, this is hip-hop now. And then, you know, somewhat hip white rock and roll now has a certain haircut and a certain style of singing and certain, you know, instrumentation. I mean, everything is so predictable. And, you know, when you come out there, we do this 3- and 4-part harmony thing and we're quoting all kinds of influences and stuff, but it's just not the influences that they happen to be selling right now.
Story from the tour so far that makes you want to stay in rock and roll and one that would make you want to go back to teaching college physics even if you never did.
Well, we had a pretty Matt just joined us in LA, we picked him up in Palm Springs, but we were in I think this one story would maybe be both was after playing Club Congress and everybody being really lit up. Winston, who was when I was touring with Dylan, was Dylan's drummer, Winston, Crazy Winston. He was there, and Chris, who's the engineer from Wavelab. Wavelab's a great studio in Tucson that Calexico, Nico, and all those people recorded there. They're like, hey, let's go over to Wavelab and you know, we're going to record, you know, and every, you know, so I gather every at 3 a.m. So then we get in this amazing studio, and it was just like this kind of like, it wasn't debauched in the sense, I mean, there weren't like enormous amounts of nudity or anything, but there were just enormous amounts of absurdity, you know. Until God only knows when in the morning, with absolutely no results other than a really drunken off-key version of Walking to New Orleans. That's all we got out of the damn session.
So basically, so much for the superstar jam concept.
Yeah. And at one point, Cornbread just walked off. He just wasn't having it anymore.
You've been very quiet. Tell me why you walked. Why did you...
I don't remember.
Yeah, so that was basically the best moment touring, and made me want to teach geophysics or whatever I was going to teach.
We've become famous for what we call a musical sandwich.
Ah.
And what the musical sandwich is we'll have the two session songs, but then I need from everybody in this room one or two songs in between by other artists that you've just always wanted to hear with the music that is on this record.
Oh, geez. To juxtapose against these songs?
Yes, to juxtapose about...
How about Cruel to Be Kind?
Okay, by Nick.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Anybody?
My Funny Valentine, Chet Baker.
Do it.
Oh, My Funny Valentine, Chet Baker.
All right.
Is that like an after the song, like a come down?
I don't know.
Why not?
Okay, well, I'll say just like a rainbow of stones.
All right.
Nice choice, Raton Pass.
Lost Highway by... Hank Williams.
Lost Highway by Hank Williams. So it's like when you have the Q&A, right? He's off camera, and I get to repeat for everybody.
Yeah, off. So being that we're unplugged, we've got me playing guitar. John's gonna do something.
Beat the desk
to death, and then all five of us are gonna sing.
All right. Well, we will pause the tape or the CD or whatever it is we're using, analog and digital, for a second. We'll get set up.
Yeah.
And thank you for yakking. Did we miss anything vitally important of historical perspective that we should have included in this interview? You know, is there any question you want to ask yourself?
Why?
1, 2, 3. Must admit I was a bit confused. Change the locks, told your friends you were through with me. Times before I would just leave this town. It's been 3 weeks and I'm still hanging around. You said it's too hard to reach you, and you've been wasting your time, 'cause you wouldn't fall in love with the literary kind. Whoa, I burned my books, would trade in my degree if that would bring you a little closer to me. I dull the edges of my critical mind, 'cause I can't stand it when you treat me unkind. Words used to come to me quickly, but now I'm mailing the lines. Yeah, 'cause you couldn't fall in love with the literary kind. No, you never fall in love with the literary kind. Say my words are outrageous. Never fall in love with the literary kind. Never fall in love.